played football and baseball and basketball. He did wrestling. He ran track. He played soccer. In college, he even wrote for 3 years for the college newspaper as their sports columnist. Then he went into the Navy, and he was a deep-sea diver in the Navy. And he finally got a job on Wall Street as a securities analyst. It's not the Harvey Milk that we know.
No.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Queer historian Lillian Federman milks the unknown Harvey. Poland's top court rejects a printer's refusal to make LGBT banners, and Tony winners rally for the resistance. Those stories and more this week, because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending June 16, 2018. Poland's Supreme Court ruled this week that a print shop employee violated the principle of equality before the law when he refused to make banners for the LGBT business forum because he didn't want to promote gay rights. The nation's top court upheld a lower court decision that the printer did not have the right to withhold services based on sexual orientation or other personal characteristics. Poland's Justice Minister and Attorney General, Zbigniew Ziobro of the ruling right-wing Law and Justice Party, brought the appeal. He angrily told reporters that the justices had served the ideology of homosexual activists. Many people, especially in the U.S., were quick to draw comparisons to last week's ruling by America's Supreme Court that upheld a Colorado baker's right, on narrow religious grounds, to refuse to make a wedding cake for a gay couple. Yaroslav Yaruga, a lawyer with the Helsinki Foundation for Human Rights, sees some similarities. But he noted that religious belief was not a specific factor in the Polish High Court decision. He said that while ruling that sexual orientation can't be the basis for refusal of service, the justices also said that there can be exceptions based on the nature of the service being rendered. Sometimes freedom of conscience and religion will be a legitimate reason for the refusal to perform the service, Yaruga explained, and at other times may constitute a manifestation of unauthorized discrimination.
Yet another U.S. federal court continues to deny President Trump's attempted ban on military service by qualified transgender enlistees from taking effect. Judge Marsha Peckman of the U.S. District Court for the Western District of the State of Washington issued a preliminary injunction against the ban in December and on June 15th denied the Trump administration's request to lift it. She said that the administration had not shown that it would suffer irreparable harm if the ban remained blocked, but that current and aspiring transgender service members would be hurt if it went into effect. The status quo shall remain, steady as she goes, she wrote, and the preliminary injunction shall remain in full force and effect nationwide. Three other federal judges around the country have also blocked the ban from becoming a reality.
June's LGBTQ Pride Month is in full swing around the world. St. Croix and the U.S. Virgin Islands celebrated Pride for the first time on June 9th, despite anonymous social media threats that participants would be gunned down en masse. Local police and agents in the FBI field office in San Juan, Puerto Rico, are reportedly investigating the threats. Anti-queer protesters who were far outnumbered by Pride marchers were kept at bay by a strong police presence. Police Chief Winsbutt McFarland told local media that, at the end of the day, these individuals pay taxes, work in our community, and are members of our community. And because of that, my obligation is to the safety of this community, and that's what we did today. The Advocate spotted a few dignitaries in the crowd, including the territory's delegate to Congress, Stacey Plaskett, and gubernatorial candidate Albert Bryan. Bryan said that people in the Caribbean, many of whom are of African descent, should be able to relate to the fight for LGBT rights. He told the Virgin Islands Consortium that 67 years ago, we were the ones who were hosed when we were marching. So we have to realize that in this world, people have a right to be who they are.
Organizers said that 500,000 people attended Rome's annual Pride celebration on June 9th. With the theme of Rainbow Brigade Liberation Continues, marchers demanded that civil marriage replace the currently available but inferior civil unions and protested the denial of adoption rights to those couples.
Thousands also celebrated Pride on June 9th in two countries that are considered to be less than friendly to LGBTQ rights. According to the Associated Press, a party-like atmosphere prevailed in Warsaw as people waved rainbow flags and danced.
A festive mood also characterized the Pride parade in the Romanian capital of Bucharest. Activists there were especially celebrating the recent European Court of Justice ruling on behalf of a Romanian gay man and his American-born husband that requires all member states to grant residency to same-gender spouses, even if the country itself, like Romania, doesn't offer civil marriage to its own lesbian and gay couples.
China's largest city, Shanghai, celebrated its 10th year of Pride on June 9th. According to a report in Time magazine, more than 40 individual events began with a 3-mile fun run and included a pink brunch, a film festival, and a trivia night. China's communist government has not been consistent in its treatment of LGBTQ people or issues, allowing some queer cultural events to go on while censoring or shutting down others, most recently some popular queer-focused web sites. Brian Song, who helped organize Shanghai Pride's The Journey of Light Choir concert that featured English and Chinese songs performed by 7 LGBT-friendly choirs from across the country, told Time that, "We were a little bit worried that maybe our concert would get canceled because of the current environment regarding LGBT in the media."
A phobic Christian minister in Anchorage, Alaska, failed miserably in his effort to preach at what has become an increasingly popular new wrinkle on Pride celebrations. Pastor Dave Grisham of Last Frontier Evangelism posted video of himself bursting into the Luzac Public Library during a private drag queen story hour. It was an official event during Anchorage's Pride Fest celebration. His unscheduled appearance didn't go over well with the children or their parents.
Morris pretends he can't hear their words over the swish, 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 crinkle, 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 and click, click, click he makes when he walks.
Hey kids, my name is Pastor David, and I wanted to tell you today that there is no such thing as there's no such thing as transgenders. Transgenders do not exist. They do not exist. God made men women, men and women women.
You do not have a ticket, sir. You do not have a ticket. You are being disruptive. You do not have the right.
Grisham is well known in the Anchorage area for disrupting queer positive events. He's even tried his homophobic and transphobic preaching at LGBT Christmas parties where children were present.
Queer fans who plan to go to football's World Cup in Moscow this week were repeatedly warned to keep a low profile. Anti-queer violence has more than doubled in Vladimir Putin's Russia since he signed a law in 2013 making the dissemination of gay propaganda to minors a crime. And his government has denied numerous credible reports of a brutally murderous anti-queer purge in Chechnya, claiming that there are no LGBT people at all in that mostly Muslim region of the country. Social media has been filled with threats by thugs to attack any perceived to be queer fans at the World Cup. Members of the Cossack militia announced that they'd be patrolling a number of the games to help police prevent gay men from kissing. The first reports of homophobic violence came on opening day. A gay couple who had traveled from France to cheer on their national team was targeted and attacked in St. Petersburg after they caught a taxi. One of the men, identified only as O. Davrius, was hospitalized after the assault with severe brain trauma and a fractured jaw. His partner, who wasn't named, was less seriously injured. They were also robbed of their money and cell phones. Two suspects are reportedly already in custody.
But finally,
I dedicate this award to the countless LGBTQ people who have fought and died for the right to live and love as we are created to.
That's Andrew Garfield accepting the Best Lead Actor in a Play trophy at the annual Tony Awards on June 10th for his performance as Prior Walter in the Broadway revival of Tony Kushner's Angels in America. The multi-talented Nathan Lane took home the award for Best Featured Actor in a Play for his role as slimy, closeted gay lawyer Roy Cohn in Angels, and Tony Kushner himself accepted the Tony for Best Revival of a Play. For each of them, the personal was also political.
I want to thank Tony Kushner for being such an adorable genius. Even his emails are Pulitzer worthy. I'm standing here because Tony wrote one of the greatest plays of the 20th century, and it is still speaking to us as powerfully as ever in the midst of such political insanity. I want to send my thanks and love, most importantly, to my to my dear husband, Devlin Elliott, the greatest blessing in my life. Thank you very much.
21 weeks till November 6th, the midterm elections. 21 weeks to make sure that the right of citizens to vote is protected and exercised. 21 weeks to save our democracy and heal our country and heal our planet. And then, what kind of a homosexual would I be if I didn't say, it's June 10th, happy birthday, Judy Garland. Bye.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending June 16th, 2018, written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the all-new thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Jessica Andrea.
He's a rebel and he'll never ever be any good. He's a rebel and he never ever does what he should.
Just because he doesn't do what everybody else does.
That's the reason why we can't share our love. He is always good to me. Good to him, I'll try to be. Cause he's my rebel and I know that he's my rebel and I know that to me.
Charismatic, eloquent, a wit, and a smart aleck. That's how Lillian Faderman describes one queer icon in her latest book, Harvey Milk, His Lives and Death. Those same words could be said of Faderman herself, who's a queer icon in her own right. The renowned LGBTQ historian talked about how she created a different kind of biography of Milk with Ralph Radabaugh and Rita Gonzalez of the KPFK Los Angeles podcast, The Out Agenda.
Lillian, besides the obvious, why Harvey Milk now, and why Harvey Milk at all? I mean, yes, he's a gay icon, incredibly interesting person, but what is it that inspired you to want to write a book about him?
I did a book called The Gay Revolution that came out in 2015, and I did a lot of research and interviews on Harvey for that book, and it's a huge book. It's an 800-page book, but I cover a period from 1948 to 2015. I finished just before it went to press. And, of course, I could only spend about maybe 15 pages on Harvey there. But I had discovered such interesting material that nobody had dealt with before. Randy Schiltz wrote a wonderful book about Harvey in 1982, the mayor of Castro Street. But the material that I found wasn't available to him. And Yale University Press came to me after The Gay Revolution, my 2015 book, came out, and asked if I would be interested in doing a book on Harvey for their series called Jewish Lives. And, of course, it took me about 10 seconds to say yes, because I had just come to admire him. And to see him for the person he was, and he was in many ways very flawed. He had a lot of warts, as I discovered, but he was also so heroic, and I think I can say that I really came to love him. There was a documentary about his life, of course, the movie Milk in 2008, and he had been, I think, more honored than any gay person. He received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. There was a stamp with his image on it that was issued. There's going to be a ship named after him. It will be the U.S. Navy ship Harvey Milk.
Well, he was kind of interesting, too, in the fact that he didn't start out as an activist. I mean, he was born in New York, came to California, landed in San Francisco in Castro Street, and opened up a camera shop.
Yeah, he was a chameleon in the true sense of the word. He was an opera lover, even as a kid. He discovered opera at the age of 11. But he became a jock in high school and in college, too, maybe to to hide that secret passion that he feared would somehow associate him with things effete. And so he played every single sport. He played football and baseball and basketball. He did wrestling. He ran track. He played soccer. In college, he even wrote for 3 years for the college newspaper as their sports columnist. Then he went into the Navy, and he was a deep-sea diver in the Navy, and he came out, didn't know what he wanted to do, but he had a credential from college, and so he taught high school for 1 year. He was really unhappy doing that. He and his lover at the time went to Dallas, Texas, where he sold sewing machines. He was unhappy doing that. He came back. He finally got a job on Wall Street as a securities analyst. It's not the Harvey Milk that we know.
No.
And he got involved with someone who was in the theater, who was very much a hippie during the 1960s. And Harvey became a hippie, grew his hair long, became a real advocate of pot smoking, dressed in denim and had a huge mustache, looked very much like a radical in the 1960s. Moved to San Francisco with his then lover. They didn't know how they would make a living, and the story is that they sent some film out to be developed at a store in the Castro, and it came back with all of the pictures virtually destroyed. And Harvey said to his lover, Scott Smith, we should open a camera store where we'll take good care of people's film. They didn't sell cameras. They couldn't afford it because they didn't have much money, but they developed film. They rented projectors. They had camera equipment, but very few cameras. They sold a few very inexpensive cameras. And in 1973, it was really a turning point in Harvey's life because the Watergate hearings happened, and he just absolutely hated Richard Nixon, but he watched the hearings faithfully. He hated John Mitchell. He hated John Dean. And he thought at that point, politics is really corrupt. Someone has to get into politics who will do it right, not the way Nixon and his team did it. He ran for office the first time in 1973. But, you know, he was complex even in his personality. For instance, he wasn't just on the board of supervisors to promote gay rights. He was very interested in promoting the rights of senior citizens. He was really interested in things like rent control, for instance. He was very interested in making coalitions with ethnic and racial minorities. He was very interested in helping young people and in the rights of young people. He was wonderful with people much of the time. I interviewed so many people who knew Harvey personally and who told me that when he talked to them, he made them feel as though whatever they were saying was the most important thing to be listening to at that time. And yet, with his lovers, he could be so explosive, really sort of insensitive. He loved them. I found love notes that would really tear at anyone's heartstrings that he wrote to his lovers. And yet, he didn't give them attention when they absolutely needed and craved his attention. He was too busy being a politician. And yet here was this guy who just absolutely loved humanity without a doubt. So that was a huge contradiction. I think he was really sincere in what he believed politically, and I think that drove him to become a politician.
If I'm fighting for gay rights, then either I'm a hypocrite or I have to fight for the rights of everybody. And once I fight for the rights of everybody, then I have to fight for the spending priorities of everybody, or I'm a hypocrite. And I don't think I'm a hypocrite, and that's why I've been involved in the issues of the district for so long, so hard. ¶¶
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin, author of Tales of the City, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio news magazine produced by, about, and for our sexually diverse communities and those who love them.
I'm Rita Gonzalez, along with Ralph Radaba. We are speaking with Lillian Faderman on her new book, Harvey Milk, His Lives and Death. How did you get all this other information on him?
Well, I did some interviews with family members who told me a lot about Harvey's family, and I write about that much more extensively than had been written about before. I start with the patriarch of the family. His grandfather came from Lithuania and was a peddler for a while, and it's just an incredible success story, so I start with that. I found letters that were not available when Randy Schiltz was writing the mayor of Castro Street, letters that were actually written to a young woman in Los Angeles. Harvey lived in Los Angeles for just a few months, but made friends with a young woman who became his confidant from 1955 to the early 1960s. And those letters were so revealing to me because Harvey told her so much of his personal life and his personal thoughts, and they had nothing to do with politics. They just had a lot to do with his romantic feelings. He had fallen in love with a young man by the name of Joe Campbell, and he was just so incredibly romantic in those letters to Susan Davis. Susan Davis Alch, she was eventually called because she got married. At one point, Harvey was just so restless because he didn't know what he wanted to do with his life, and he spills that part of his life out to Susan Davis. So it was just a whole view of him that nobody had talked about before. I also discovered letters and notes that he wrote to the guy who was actually the director of Hair on Broadway and Jesus Christ Superstar, a man by the name of Tom O'Horgan. He and Tom O'Horgan became very good friends. And Tom was a correspondent even when Harvey moved to San Francisco. And when Harvey was finally elected to the Board of Supervisors, he wrote these wonderful notes to Tom O'Horgan that really gave another insight into him. Just his great pride in having been elected, and he wrote to Tom about how he was going to have a banquet celebrating his election, and Mervyn Dimely, who was the lieutenant governor of California, would be a speaker at the banquet, and he said something to the effect of, who would believe that this faggot would have a banquet in his honor in which the lieutenant governor would give a speech, and then he invited Tom O'Horgan to come to the banquet. He was invited by the San Diego Opera to sit in a VIP box to watch an opera singer that Harvey very much admired, who was already 68 years old, and Harvey had seen him when he was a kid at the Metropolitan Opera, where he was standing in the standing room. And he wrote to Tom O'Horgan about that experience, which was so exciting to him. He talked about sitting next to another famous opera singer in this VIP box. And he said to Tom O'Horgan, oh, life can be so wonderful. And I found that note so moving because it was actually written 2 days before his assassination.
It's amazing to have these letters that people had. I mean, nowadays people don't even do letters. It's just,
I know. I worry so much about
I do, too. I was story. Thinking about that right now. I said, because that's how you found out about people, who they were by their letters, not emails.
Right. I don't know what future historians are going to do, because so much of these great archives where I've done so much of my work, the collections are mostly letters, and what's going to happen when there aren't letters like that?
Lillian, is there any chance that you have a short little passage from the book that you'd like to read?
Yes, I would be happy to do that, yeah. Should I read from the introduction? Is that
sure, if that's what you'd like to read from.
Okay. Harvey Milk, charismatic, eloquent, a wit and a smart aleck, was one of the first openly gay men to be elected to any political office anywhere. On November 18, 1977, soon after he won a seat on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, he made three tape recordings that he distributed to close friends to be played only in the event of my death by assassination, he instructed at the beginning of each tape. Though he did not keep it a secret from associates that he had made the tapes, when his irreverent young City Hall intern, Cleve Jones, learned of them, he teased Harvey, "Hey, you're not Martin Luther King. You're not important enough." Harvey was shot to death 1 year and 9 days later by Dan White, a fellow supervisor who had complained that San Francisco was being turned into Sodom by men who would not hide their homosexuality, and that Harvey Milk was in the forefront of the city's abhorrent transformation. The words Harvey dictated into his tape recorder would have sounded foolishly melodramatic had he died a natural death, but with his murder, they took on the weight of prophecy. "If a bullet should enter my brain," he had said on the tape he made for his friend Frank Robinson, "let that bullet destroy every closet door."
I'm Rita Gonzalez, along with Ralph Radaba.
Our guest has been
Lillian Faderman with her book, Harvey Milk, His Lives and Death.
Every gay person must come out. As difficult as it is, you must tell your immediate family. You must tell your relatives. You must tell your friends, if indeed they are your friends. You must tell your neighbors. You must tell the people you work with. You must tell the people in the stores you shop in. And once you do, you will feel so much better.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Jessica Andrea and Michael LeBeau, with thanks to Brian DeShazer, and from Rita Gonzalez and Ralph Radaba. Buena Vista performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Help keep our 30-year streak going at the all-new thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 4NSA Noosa, Queensland, WJSC Johnson, Vermont, KOOP Austin, Texas, and on more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.